Now, this will likely come as a great surprise to many, so get ready. Before we had electricity, we had food. It's true. Before we had refrigerators and telephones and televisions and computers and all the devices and gizmos made possible by electricity, we had food. And so today we ask, how did we preserve our food without electricity?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 696th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there in Kowloon who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain radio page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Folks, we have come a long way since Benjamin Franklin hung a key on a kite and proved up the efficacy of electricity. Today, the flow of electrons animates the devices that make possible all kinds of modern times activities, like living in cities, for one. But surprising as it will sound to some, we did have food before the refrigerator, and so today we pause to ask, how did we preserve our food without electricity? And who better to ask than Jennifer McGessey, who's the proprietor of Vermont's Fat Rooster Farm and author of Root Cellar, Canning, Freezing, Drying, Smoking, and Preserving the Harvest. Jennifer, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Thank you.
So good to have you back. It's been like 66 weeks since we last worked together on the joy of keeping chickens.
That's right.
Well, listen, I got to tell you a story. We did that show 66 weeks ago, and now I hear chickens clucking away in my next-door neighbor's backyard. So I hope your prescience doesn't hold true as we discuss food without electricity. That would be a frightening proposition for city people. But it is interesting to note that there are chickens being heard in the cities across the land now. So, well done.
Thanks. I'm happy to hear that it's catching on.
Well, and why is it catching on?
Well, I think that people want to have a sense of independence and security and the ability to, as you say, live without a refrigerator maybe.
Yeah. And I came to work this morning, and the young intern, she said, I brought eggs. I have eggs in the refrigerator for you. And I thought, well, that was pretty interesting because, like, 18 trillion eggs were just recalled because they were contaminated with salmonella. And here's a young gal, you know, fresh out of college, who's just, learning her way in the world, and she's got 8 young chickens, and they're laying eggs, and she's bringing eggs into the staff here at the radio station and say, here, these don't have salmonella in them.
Right.
What a joy that is, right?
Oh, it's wonderful. I always say you should probably buy your eggs from some farmer with 50 eggs on hand instead of 2.3 million at a time.
And, we'd all probably be much better off if we were to do that. Fat Rooster Farm, tell the audience a little bit about the Fat Rooster Farm for those who didn't catch the last episode we worked on together.
Okay, it's a small family farm run by myself, my husband, and my 10-year-old son, Bradford. We're on the second branch of the White River in Vermont, in central Vermont. We own about 20 acres, and we farm about 160 total. We have chickens, beef, pork, lamb, turkeys, and about 2 acres of vegetables.
And you have a master's degree in wildlife biology and fish work for the Fish and Game Department, right?
Right, for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I did for 12 years.
Uh-huh. And do you think must have had a lot to do with where you're going with food and animals?
Well, yeah, I've always had a love for animals and for living things, but I did find myself getting locked in the ivory tower and farther away from my food source, so I just decided to take a totally different track and get back to farming in the land.
Why look back, Jennifer? I mean, you know, we're we've achieved this remarkable degree of civilization, I guess if that's what you could call it, where millions of people can live in a concrete edifice we call the city. Why should we look back on food that is refrigerated, I guess?
Why should we explore its origins, or why should we...
Why should we look back? Why shouldn't we just look further on down the road of industrializing our food chain so that we don't have to count on anything? We can live on food that comes in boxes and manufactured from genetically engineered soybeans that have been enriched with Chinese-made vitamins and sterilized with spent nuclear fuel, whatever.
I think that's a little scary, don't you? I mean, we're compartmentalizing everything, and the whole egg scare is a perfect example of that. A couple of farms distributed to many different sources or centers, and now we have this big widespread problem. If we each have a little experience in preserving food ourselves, or at least hooking up with somebody that knows how to do that, I think food safety might not be such a big issue.
And, I have a photograph in my collection of my grandmother, and you open up your book with almost exactly the same story, the story of a grandmother in a root cellar with jars and jars and jars of preserved food in back of her. It's just an amazingly colorful, beautiful photograph of a little old lady standing in front of all of this food that she has set aside, she has put by for the winter. And there's something amazingly comforting about it, but there's also something very secure about it. You know, here she is, she can make it.
That's absolutely right. I sometimes feel like, especially right now in this season, I feel like a squirrel who's storing away nuts for the winter just to make sure I have enough put by. I mean, this morning I did 18 quarts of tomato sauce, and I smoked some bacons, and we're harvesting for the root cellar, and there is a sense of security and coziness.
Well, you know, you also brought up the story about your son being confronted with the conflict between the foods that you make yourself, that you grow yourself, and the industrialized foods that come in plastic wraps. And when your child goes to school, you know, they look in their lunch bag and they see these, what we would consider absolutely wonderful whole foods, and yet, you know, it's the attraction of the peer group that they turn to the other stuff. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's true. It's very hard, and you don't want to, have your child be picked on at school, but you can teach them at home just to pick up some simple techniques or practices to eat better than they've been taught to by the commercials on TV or on the internet. And that can be just as simple as taking an apple and peeling it and putting it on a plate and maybe sprinkling a little teeny bit of cinnamon and maple sugar on it. And that way they get this sense that, yes, this has the sugar that those little packages are promising, but it's a little healthier for you.
Do you ever read labels with them? With your child?
Yeah, actually, we were reading one in the car yesterday. He was drinking some sort of soda or sparkling water thing, and he couldn't pronounce the chemicals in the juice or whatever it was.
And what kind of impression did that leave with him?
He actually is getting it. I mean, he sees that. You know, that these things are not good for him. And, you know, with the news and the stories about the eggs and all the people getting sick, that's really resonated for him. But he's still, you know, he's still a 10-year-old, and he's still attracted to the Fruit Loops box with the fortified with 14 different vitamins. So, you know, it's a constant battle.
It's a constant battle. Do you ever know of anybody in your neighborhood to get sick from your chickens or your eggs?
No, absolutely not. We're so small, and we're so if that happened to us, then it would be devastating. We take very good care not to have those things happen. And our chickens and our eggs are not, you know, in tiny little compartmentalized cages and without sunlight and fresh tomatoes.
Right. Okay, folks, you're tuned into The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about putting food by. We're talking about food without electricity. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine not having a refrigerator? What would we eat? Where would we go? Well, that's what we're going to learn today from The Joy of Keeping a Root Cellar by Jennifer McGessie, who is the proprietor of Fat Rooster Farm up in Vermont. And today we are unable to take phone calls, but you can always join us on the internet at metrofarm.com. Go to the forums there, and you can participate in the programs. I'd love to hear about what foods your family put by to get by. We will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking with Jennifer McGessie, the author of Root Cellar, Canning, Freezing, Drying, Smoking, and Preserving the Harvest, and also the proprietor of Fat Rooster Farm. Do you really have a fat rooster, Jennifer?
Oh, I have several fat roosters.
And they have a very important job around the farm, right?
That's right, to wake me up in the morning.
Uh-huh. And before the break, and I was introducing the program, Jennifer also wrote a book called The Joy of Keeping Chickens, which we featured in a previous edition of The Food Chain, over a year ago. And,
that's right.
And the amazing thing was after that program, you know, a couple of months ago, I started hearing chickens in the neighbor's backyard, and I thought, yes, it's happening. It's happening. So Jennifer had an occasion to enjoy a wonderful party at a friend's house up in the mountains. Everybody bought a little bit of something to eat and to share. And one person from a little Croatian community showed up with a beautiful smoked ham.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my. I've never experienced anything like that, and which is amazing because I've been around farming and agriculture so much. But it was a prosciutto ham.
Oh, wow.
And they had got together as a community and smoked 28 of them at one time. And they smoked them for, I don't know, forever, and you know, with a low-burning applewood fire. And it was just incredibly delicious, and it was fun. It became like the centerpiece of the entire festivity, you know, the cutting of the ham. And so I thought today maybe we could start with preserving meat and move down the line to dairy and vegetables, but I thought, in honor of that ham, we'd start there. And of course, you do have animals, and you do harvest them, and you do preserve them, right?
Right.
So how do you go about preserving meat then without freezing them?
Okay, well, what I did today, just earlier this morning, was I took my hams and my ham hocks and my bacons out of a brine that I have in a non-reactive container that's chilled below 40 degrees, and it's a mix of salt and sugar and spices and some curing salt. And the meat is cured in that brine.
What do you mean cured?
It's preserved. So the salt and sugars actually draw out the moisture and then force back the water and moisture back into the meat, in and out, in and out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it creates an environment that is not conducive to growing bad bacteria. And then after that, after the cure, that the ham has been preserved, you take it and then you smoke it. And I use a cold smoke, which means that it's not fully cooked, so you'd have to cook it afterwards. And that's just achieved by, I have a little smoker that I got in the hardware store for $90. And I use apple wood. I use the stalks from garlic that I've harvested.
Oh, yeah.
Some people use hickory. And then I smoke it slowly. So it's never really hot enough to cook the meat, and that just forms a film on the outside mm-hmm. of the meat, so it doesn't let bacteria get inside.
Kind of a real thick crust.
Right.
We had a heck of a time cutting through that crust. You know, you had to have a real sharp knife.
That's absolutely true, and you can, you know, some people like to cut the rind off, and then you could use it to make baked beans or split pea soup. Or some people just like to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the colonial days, what they would do is, because there wasn't refrigeration and they were relying on ice houses or spring houses to keep their meat cool, they also wanted that thick layer on their meat to keep any insects out.
Right. So it formed the crust, and the crust was like the equivalent of the plastic wrapper today, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so you, how do you store these meats now?
You can store them. Some people can them. I've stored them in my root cellar before.
Mm-hmm.
You can freeze them. You know, you can rely on the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm. So when you store them in your roots, tell people, first of all, what the heck a root cellar is. Because a lot of people probably have not even been inside a root cellar before.
Well, a traditional root cellar was something that probably came over from England to North America, and it was part of your house. And usually it was in the basement of the house, in the dirt floor of the house. And it's an area that's colder and more humid and dark. So it allows for storage of food, such as meat and vegetables, for a longer period of time.
Probably the closest thing we come to a root cellar these days is a wine cellar, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But a root cellar could be anything from, you know, a box that's put in the spare bedroom that holds the onions, to a temperature-controlled, humidity-controlled room that's separate from the rest of your house.
And what did it take, when you say you stored your meats in the root cellar, how did you do that without, you just hung them up?
Yeah, so what I did was, after I cured them, I put a spice cure on the outside, and it developed a crust, almost like a cheese rind would.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, pancetta, that's how they make pancetta. And you cut that off and don't eat it, and you just, the meat inside has been preserved and is good. It's like pemmican, also was a Native mm-hmm. American dried meat.
And what about jerky? Do you make jerkies?
Yeah, jerky is very easy to make. It's really fun, and kids love to do it. And you can do that as simply as, you know, again, you want to have a spice cure, and you season the meat almost like a marinade, and it's just as easy as sticking it in your oven at a very low temperature to
mm-hmm.
dry out. Or you can be more elaborate and buy a dehydrator, a food dehydrator, and they're not very expensive, and dry it that way.
And what about sun-drying?
You can sun-dry it. The only thing with sun-drying, I mean, absolutely, that's the oldest form of drying meat.
Sure.
But you have to make sure that it's protected from the rain and from your house cats and insects and things like that.
And the neighbor.
And the neighbor.
And the neighbor's kids, and it, right?
Right.
Now, a little bit earlier we were talking about the relationship your son is having with coming to grips with your food and the industrial food. Now, do you host other children on your farm?
Yes, and it's pretty funny when we have kids over because I serve things like black currant jam or rhubarb jelly or lemon balm sorbet and just these very wild things that they haven't usually heard of. And they're pretty good about trying them usually.
And their experiences are probably pretty interesting too because they're experiencing these foods in the real sense probably for the first time.
Yes, and school children love to come here for tours. In fact, I've done several gleaning tours where we go out into the fields after a frost and we search for things that I've missed, and they run around and find them, and they just get overjoyed finding these forgotten squash or onions, and they're not scared about tasting a Swiss chard leaf that survived the frost or grabbing a carrot out of the ground and munching on it. So it's pretty fun.
It's almost like the traditional Easter egg hunt then.
Yeah, exactly.
Running around finding food. Well, folks, you're tuned into The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking with Jennifer McGessie, the author of The Joy of Keeping a Root Cellar, Canning, Freezing, Drying, Smoking, and Preserving the Harvest. And essentially we're considering how on earth we ate before there was electricity, before we went into the kitchen and opened up the refrigerator and we stand there and staring at what's there. What was there before there was a refrigerator? How did we preserve our food? How did we get by? How did we put food by so that we could get by? I am Michael Olson, Jennifer McGessie. Again, the book is The Joy of Keeping a Root Cellar, a beautiful book and very fun to look through. When we come back, we're going to talk about preserving dairy products. And do stay tuned. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about food before electricity with Jennifer McGessie, author of The Joy of Keeping a Root Cellar. Ever been in a root cellar? What a fun feeling it is to go down into that root cellar where it's cool and dark and see row after row of mason jars filled with all kinds of delicious-looking homegrown foods. Jennifer, can we preserve food at home, even those of us who live in a city?
Oh, absolutely. It's not as hard as it seems if you look at row upon row of jarred foods in the grocery store. You can do that at home.
And you can probably do it with the food that you and your friends and your, and even if you don't grow things yourself, you can get them from your local farmers.
Right, or farmers markets are all over the country now, so you can go there and ask for 20 pounds of pickling cucumbers and go home and make dill pickles.
And what a great place to start, too, with something as simple as pickles. Let's talk about dairy. I had an opportunity earlier this week to go on a really interesting ag tour. A group of hotels put together a tour of local agriculture, and they asked me to come along to just look at it. So we went on toured a number of different ag products, everything from fish to avocados to goats and so on. And I had a wonderful opportunity to visit a goat farm, and they're making goat cheese. And it was just a wonderful experience to have the opportunity to actually milk a goat and help make the cheese. So tell us a little bit about how we preserve dairy.
Well, any form, as you say, any form of cheese is preserved dairy products, and probably one of the simplest things to preserve for starting out would be to make buttermilk or yogurt. And buttermilk is very easy. All you have
what
to
exactly
do
is buttermilk?
Well, buttermilk, traditionally, buttermilk was actually the runoff of what was left after churning the butter. But what I'm talking about is the more modern cultured buttermilk that's thicker, and it has living cultures in it that actually transform the lactose in the milk into other better for you, easier to digest proteins. And so with buttermilk, all you have to do is get any cultured buttermilk from the store, or you can get starters that they're very easy to get on the internet. And so for about every quart jar, you'd add a quarter cup of the cultured buttermilk and just shake it and put it in a warm place, 70 to 75 degrees for about 24 hours, and then it will be transformed into buttermilk, and you store it in your refrigerator.
And buttermilk used to be very popular way back when. It used to be, before refrigeration, it used to be much more commonplace than it is now, right?
Yes, absolutely. Buttermilk and yogurt. I mean, the modern-day yogurt, if you care to read the ingredients in most of the yogurt for sale in the stores, it has far more ingredients in it than really the traditional yogurts used to have.
Mostly, like, sugar?
Lots of sugar, yeah.
Now, I was reading the one of those little, you know, containers of yogurt, and I was amazed at the amount of sugar that they put inside of them. Why is that? I mean, do we crave sweets that much?
I think we crave sweets and fat and salt, and yeah, that's a way to get the kids to eat yogurt, is to put sugar in it. But you could instead get plain yogurt, which is far less money to buy in the quart containers, and add just a little bit of homemade jelly or maple syrup or honey
and there
as a
you go.
Sweetener.
And the child would probably realize then a lot more of what they're eating and have more cognition of what they're putting in their bodies. What about making cheese? How do we go about making cheese?
Making cheese is a little bit more of a process. Probably if you wanted to make cheese, the easiest one to start with would be mozzarella. That's pretty simple. And there's lots of different recipes for mozzarella. My favorite is out of Barbara Kingsolver's book, Animal Vegetable Miracle. But it requires is heating the milk to a certain temperature, then adding some citric acid and letting the milk cool back down, and then stretching those curds into the mozzarella.
Huh.
And it's very simple, and it takes only a couple hours.
Are we talking about whole milk?
We're talking about whole milk. We're talking about not ultra-pasteurized milk. It can be pasteurized and homogenized if you want. I use organic raw milk.
Now where do you get that?
Right across the road. But
okay.
I think it's actually easier to get these days, raw milk, even in the cities.
Well, that's an interesting one. We'll be looking at that one on the food chain here shortly. So after mozzarella, what's next?
You mean as far as advancing on your cheese-making skills?
And do you make cheese on your farm?
I make a mozzarella, and I make yogurt and butter. I have made goat cheese before, Chev, and I've made cheddar.
Mm-hmm.
My sister makes a lot of cheese. But I'm not that patient to go in and make the aged cheeses.
Okay, fair enough. You have to be patient.
Yes.
Yes. And any other, what about just butter? Tell us about making butter.
Butter is so simple to do. All you need is heavy cream. So if you have a source of heavy cream, you get it to room temperature. You put it in a jar, like a quart jar, and you shake it back and forth until it solidifies.
Mm-hmm. Or churn it if you have
Yes, turning it in a butter churn is mm-hmm. really fun to do too.
And then one of my big treats on going on this ag tour was goat ice cream.
Mm.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. Whoa! How do we make ice cream?
Well, you can make ice cream and sorbet with an ice cream maker. Again, they're not very expensive. My husband makes a really good vanilla ice cream.
It should be against the law to use electricity, though, don't you think?
Yeah, you don't need to use electricity. What I do is, like for my sorbets, I've made a rhubarb sorbet. You just heat the sugar and the rhubarb on your stove, and once it all goes into a solution, you can pour it into a big baking dish and then stick it in the freezer. Oh, there's that electricity word.
There it is.
Yeah, I don't know how you'd make butter unless the really old-fashioned way with the rock salt, and you can get those little balls that you kick around, and it churns the ice cream.
Well, I've made ice cream that way, and it tastes really good when you're done churning it.
Uh-huh.
Because you're doing all of this work churning it, and all of a sudden you have something there for all of your efforts. Folks, this is a Food Chain. We're having a little fun today talking about food without electricity. You know, there was food before we had refrigerators. You know, we're all intent on going to into the kitchen, opening up the refrigerator, and there's food. Well, we had food before there was refrigerators, so how did we preserve them and put them by so that we could get by? We're talking with Jennifer McGessie, the author of Joy of Keeping a Root Cellar, Canning, Freezing, Drying, Smoking, and Preserving the Harvest. Do stay tuned. We will be right back, and we're talking about vegetables when we return. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about preserving food without electricity, with Jennifer McGessie, author of The Joy of Keeping a Root Cellar. And that must be fun, digging a root cellar. I have a friend up in the mountains who dug a root cellar, and he's storing his wine in there, but that's what I was reminded of when he let me into his little cave in the mountains there. I was thinking this is just like a root cellar, and I was expecting to see rows of food stored away and whatnot. What a fun place to visit if you ever get a chance. It's just a beautiful thing to see. And you store a lot of things in there. Of course, you can store your own vegetables and eggs and whatnot. How do you preserve eggs? How do you keep eggs, Jennifer?
Well, eggs are good at temperatures just hovering above freezing, like 40 degrees, for several weeks. So you can just put them in their egg cartons and put them in a root cellar that's at that temperature. You can also pickle eggs very easily and can them.
How do you do that?
Pardon?
How do you pickle an egg?
Well, you just have a brine solution of vinegar and water and salt and spices. I use dill and garlic. And you heat the solution and take hard-boiled eggs and put them in the jars, and then you seal them in a hot water bath because they're in such a high acid solution. It's safe to can them without pressure canning them.
Okay, there's two ways of doing this, as I remember from writing about it. This one is a pressure way of doing it, and the other is just a hot water. There are two ways, right?
Yes.
What are they?
Well, the one way that you were describing, the pressure canner, actually gets the temperature high enough to kill the bacteria that causes botulism.
So essentially you're pasteurizing.
You're pasteurizing, but you can't get to that temperature if you're just straight boiling. So you have to, with any low acid food, you need to use a pressure canner in order to be absolutely safe.
What is an example of a low acid food?
So low acid foods are beans, corn, peanuts, anything like that.
Okay.
High acid foods would be tomatoes, fruit, and any vinegar product like pickles or pickled eggs or pickled beets, anything like that.
So that's why we tend to see more high acid foods being preserved than low acid foods, right?
Well, yeah.
It's just a little simpler to do?
It is simpler, and I think there is a bit of a fear around pressure canning, but it really isn't that big of a deal. The pressure canners of today are very well made, and it's simple to use them as well.
Mm-hmm. I don't even think I've seen a modern pressure canner. I just saw the old pressure cookers that my folks used to use. Do you have one?
Uh-huh.
And where did you find it?
I found it on Amazon.
Where else, right?
Yeah.
Okay. There it is. Huh. Right next to The Joy of Keeping a Root Cellar.
Right.
Right. Well, good. Okay, so we have high acid foods, low acid foods.
Mm-hmm.
How do we do low acid foods? Tell us about the pressure cooking then.
Well, the pressure, then what you would have to do is with the low-acid foods, you can either raw pack them, which means they're not cooked beforehand, or you can hot pack them. And then you have to seal them just as you would with the hot water bath products in canning jars with lids and rings, and you put them in the pressure canner, and you have to get them up to a certain amount of pressure and cook them for a prescribed amount of time.
So they're sealed in the jars.
They're sealed in the jar, and the difference is that they've been exposed to much higher heat than those products that you had in the hot water bath.
Don't the jars blow up?
No, no.
When they're sealed?
No, they do not blow up. And because the pressure inside the canner is what keeps, it's like an autoclave.
Okay, good. So that keep the pressure inside the pressure cooker keeps the pressure equalized.
Right.
Right. Okay, good enough. And for the high acid foods?
High acid foods are very easy to cook and to can in a hot water bath. So I make dilly beans a lot, and I use equal parts of vinegar and water and salt, not equal salt, but I put salt in there, and garlic cloves, and I put grape leaves and peppercorns and sometimes coriander, and I heat up the brine and heat up the jars, and then I stick the raw beans in the jars after they've been heated up. And I fill them with the hot brine, seal the jar, put it in the hot water bath, and I put it in there for 20 minutes, and then they're done.
Does this take an especially large amount of time to put food by, Jennifer?
I think you have to make time for it, but it's hard to, especially now with our abundance of food out in the garden. Mm-hmm. All you want to do is just think about eating fresh stuff. But here, at least, we may have a frost in 2 weeks, which means the end of all the beans, all the tomatoes, all of the basil. And so I just have to keep in mind that I want to get those things preserved now so I have them for later. And so I set aside a day or a couple hours every day to do some canning.
Budget the time to put your food by so you can get by. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Jennifer McGessy, the author of The Joy of Keeping a Root Cellar, and also The Joy of Keeping Chickens, too, and the proprietor of Fat Rooster Farm up there in Vermont, where it does snow. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how we city people can get in touch with the food that we eat. Do stay tuned. We will be right back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Jennifer McGessy. Do stay tuned. So many things to talk about in so little time. Michael Olson here. This is The Food Chain. We're talking about the joy of keeping a root cellar on The Food Chain with the author of SED, with Jennifer McGessy. Jennifer, what is root cellaring?
It's probably the easiest method of preserving food for later consumption. Basically, what it is say you harvest potatoes, you take those potatoes, you don't even have to wash them, and you store them in an area that has the temperature and the humidity that will keep those vegetables for months.
Months?
Yes. Sometimes I have onions that I harvest in July and I'm eating in February.
So that they'll last a long time
That
root cellaring.
Yes.
Wow. That is a long time. And how long does the food that you put by in the fall last you through the winter?
We are still eating things such as beets, potatoes, parsnips, Jerusalem artichokes, well into spring, into April and May.
And almost until the new things start coming in the garden.
That's right.
How can we city people start getting involved in putting a little bit of food by, but not only putting the food by, but taking a little bit of control of our lives?
Well, you could do two things. You could get involved in your local farmer's market, and you could ask farmers, they probably do have root cellars, to set aside food for you. You could join a CSA and community-supported agriculture, and sometimes they have winter shares, and they have storage areas for vegetables. Or you could just make a root cellar yourself. It doesn't have to be a really complex design. And like I said, it could be just a container that you stick under the bed in the spare bedroom, and you could store your onions and garlic there.
Which would make a very interesting smell in the bedroom. Huh? good. So your son is 10, right?
Mm-hmm.
What does he enjoy most from your root cellar when he goes down into the root cellar?
Well, he has braces now, so he's upset that he can't eat carrots anymore.
Oh.
But he loves potatoes. He loves beets. We have turnips, and he likes those.
So he's a 10-year-old boy, and he actually likes these things?
He does. He does. It's a battle every day, but I have to remind him that they're very nutritious for him, and he does enjoy them.
So in root cellaring, not only do we get to taste our own food and to preserve our own food, but we really get to take a little bit more control of our lives and experience the joy of putting things by to get by. Folks, this has been The Food Chain, Michael Olson, with Jennifer McGessey, The Joy of Keeping a Root Cellar. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.